Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Good morning, everyone. Beautiful day here.
It is. It's a sunny December day.
Yes, love it, love it.
No snow. Well, there's still a few piles of snow left from the big storm.
Well, yeah, because that was a big one we had. But
But other than that, there's no snow. And when my grandkids get here for Christmas or right after Christmas, they're really hoping to see some snow. So hopefully.
Well, okay. Let's not have too much, though.
Not too much. That is true. So who do we have with us today, Mom?
Today we have John B. Lane, who is an award-winning author and instructional designer, and a pioneer in online learning. He began his professional career as a journalist and has written for numerous publications from the Washington Post to the Huffington Post. And his book today is The Beaten Path, A Lyrical Guide to Lucid Evolution. And it is a most interesting book. You start reading it, and then you have to go back and read it again. It really is good, really.
And welcome to Writer's Voices, John.
Thank you. It's nice to be here with you.
So let's start out. Tell us a little bit of your background in writing.
Well, as Caroline noted, I did start my career as a journalist many years ago, and then just sort of ended up pursuing all kinds of different types of writing, which I think, you know, maybe partially explains the way the book itself came out, the way The Beaten Path came out. But I, as I say, journalism, and then I wrote some short stories, screenplays. I got into advertising, so I wrote radio and TV ads for a while. Then I sort of ended up in this career of instructional design, which actually calls on me to, you know, utilize a lot of my writing skills, including, I just want to note, I write emails a lot during the course of the day, and I think in retrospect, it really helps kind of sharpen one's skills as a writer to have to write those concise messages, really important information back and forth. So anyway, just a lot of different things that sort of developed skills and muscles in my writing abilities over the years. And
It's interesting you mentioned emails as something that improves your writing skills, because so many people kind of ignore a lot of the rules of grammar, punctuation, sentence structure, and so forth in emails. Do you do that, or are you more careful?
Well, I would say I took the liberty of ignoring some of the rules of, you know, the conventions and rules of grammar a little bit in The Beaten Path, but in my everyday work, you know, these are professional, you know, communications back and forth. So it's really, that's not a luxury that I have. You have to, you know, really, you know, kind of portray yourself as literate and, you know, to be able to think and communicate really clearly in brief, concise messages. So I think maybe the professional email has different requirements maybe than personal emails do.
That's true. That's true. Although I will say in the business world, you see a lot of pretty sloppy emails, and I hate to say it, but I think I've fallen prey to that a little bit myself too.
Yeah, I think that maybe the rules are a little bit looser, but I think, you know, it's in everyone's interest to try to, you know, present themselves as, you know, literate and, you know, of clear thought.
Right. Okay, so what inspired you to write The Beaten Path? And maybe before you say that, maybe you should say what it is, because it's not kind of a normal book.
No, it absolutely isn't. It isn't, and it wasn't intended to be. So there are all kinds of reasons that go into that. One of the reasons why it doesn't, I think, look and sort of feel like a more typical book is that, you know, one of the key central themes of the book is, you know, what I advocate is the need for kind of fresh thinking and thinking that isn't sort of limited by, typical standards and assumptions and things like that. And so it seemed to me that on the one hand, it was important to write a book that reflected its own themes. And so that was one of the reasons, and there were other reasons too that had to do with just, my situation as a writer, having to basically write a book in my part time because of the day job. And so it also allowed me to draw on, these different kind of writing skills that I developed over the years to be able to write a book that didn't use a single voice throughout the book, but really used all kinds of different styles and voices, which I thought made some pretty, kind of otherwise serious themes, I hope, a little bit more engaging for a reader.
Well, it did that, that's for sure. And the illustrations, too, they're really something.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you mentioned those things.
How did you come up with that? I mean, how'd that happen?
Well, I had these different pieces and different styles, and it just seemed like it really needed more. It needed something else to kind of, elevate and engage readers. Mm-hmm. And, I'm not a graphic designer myself, so I was referred to a wonderful woman in Quebec named Anil Prakash, who is a graphic designer, and she and I worked long distance for about a year and a half or 2 years on the layout. And she kind of guided me in a direction that was based on what I had in mind, which was sort of a look that was was fresh but not necessarily trendy or contemporary. I wanted something that had sort of a little bit of a timeless feel to it. And so she pointed us to a couple of amazing resources, including this resource. I think it's fairly recent. The British Library has made available online this vast and wonderful archive of classic graphic illustrations, many of which from, the 19th century, kind of a golden age of illustration. And we found all kinds of wonderful images that, that really helped, I think, kind of inform and create an interplay with some of the pieces. So we had a lot of fun doing that. I spent almost as much time on the layout as actually writing the book.
Yeah, I can believe that. Yeah. Well, it certainly turned out well. I mean, it adds a great deal to it.
Thank you.
So the book is, the writing is mostly poetic. Would you consider all the pieces poems or some of them essays?
I would consider actually, I guess, a little bit of both. I mean, clearly a lot of the pieces are pretty much, just clearly poetry. But I really did have a style that, sort of evolved in my personal writing over the years, where I tried to blend elements of poetry even in some of the essays. I think, some of the pieces in there I would consider essays, but I tried to utilize some of the elements of poetry, rhythm and some internal rhyming as I wrote, just because I guess my mind kind of thinks that way, and it just makes it more kind of a unique voice for me, and just a little bit more fun to read, and I hope a little bit more engaging, more fun to write, I should say, and I hope it's more engaging to read.
Kind of formatted like poems too.
Yes, many of them are, and that has to do also with with the fact that we kind of laid out each page as a custom piece. Back to these illustrations that we were talking about, and so the idea is that the illustrations, the lyrics, the words, there's sort of an interwoven interplay throughout the book, because again. The idea is just to try to do something that doesn't look like any other book and creates a sort of almost subliminal experience that's unique. I think it's important, if that's what you're really advocating, to sort of model that in the way the book was presented. So that's really why we did it that way.
Well, I would say that that was a success, because I've never ever seen a book like this. And, you know, like I said, you read it, and then you have to go back and read it again, and you find new things in each piece that you missed the first time.
Well, thank you. That was also kind of one of the intentions as well. You know, the idea of maybe not necessarily just hitting people over the head with, this is what I'm saying and this is what I mean and here it is, but to kind of provoke thinking and reflection. That was definitely one of the aims.
Well, and it is a kind of a provocative subject matter and maybe somewhat controversial in a sense. You're trying to... You're looking at or talking about things that people believe,
yes,
and trying to provoke some thought about why do you believe this? Where did this belief come from? Is it really your belief, or has it been something that was, given to you or pressed upon you?
Yes.
And what are you going to do about it? And I'm wondering is there something in the current political situation that really motivated you to get this to do this?
I would say yes, absolutely. Actually, it was the sort of original inspiration for the book. That's maybe not the right word under the circumstances, but it really does go all the way back, I think, in my mind, to 9/11, and not only to 9/11, but our reaction to 9/11, which I found really puzzling in a lot of ways, and I started thinking about why would we react the way we did, and ended up kind of coming up and coming across what I felt were some kind of common things at work that seem like root causes to some of the what I feel are the some of the problems that we have today. And as you note, I think that these beliefs or belief systems, I think, are one of the kind of root sources of much of our difficulty, because they lock us into ways of thinking that disable our ability to really have clear, clear approaches to solutions that, to problems and solutions. If you have a fixed point of view, you're not able to take new information in and use it to adjust to ever-changing circumstances. And I think, although, like I say, my original impulse came from, way back when, I think many of those things, I still see them affecting what we do today. And it's across all kinds of spectrums, political and religious and all kinds of different ways. But the fact is, I think we're painting ourselves into corners by doing this. So I hope that I, explain some of this clearly in the book. There's some kind of complicated ideas, I guess, in a way, but I tried to paint them in ways to make them easier for people to see and understand. And I hope some of that came across.
Why do you think it is that people get so defensive about their belief systems that not only are they not willing to look at anything or that doesn't fit that system, and in fact they will call facts or evidence that disputes that, they'll call it fake news or fake science or just not even consider it. But even beyond that, people are so defensive about their belief systems that they are willing to hate and even kill somebody who thinks differently. Is this just part of human nature?
I think it is. It is part of human nature. And I think, there are some biological roots in the human brain that we can talk about. But I think that what happens is, in many cases, is that, these are not conscious decisions that are made. We absorb these things, from our families and from the culture around us, and they just become sort of part of our way of thinking, and a part of our thinking that we've never really, kind of consciously considered or examined. And then they become part of our identity, and they sort of they become articles of faith. And again, one of the points I try to make is that there are things that become articles of faith that aren't just religious in nature. They can be political or conspiracy theories, superstitions, all kinds of things. And you know, people sort of lock in on this idea as something, okay, this is what I believe, and anything that challenges that is almost a threat to my personal identity. And I think that's really where a source of much of the trouble is, that there are, these things are taken as givens and cannot be questioned, and evidence really or reason or other points of view really have no impact. And in some cases, they actually strengthen people's, you know, they cause people to kind of, I think, dig in with these fixed beliefs. And as I say, I think, we may want to talk at some point about the kind of two parts of the human brain that I talk about in The Beaten Path. You know, the amygdala, which is sort of the original part of our brain from which we have our fears and, you know, our kind of selfish impulses, and the prefrontal cortex, which is where we've evolved into these higher, you know, higher order thinking that allow us to, you know, learn how to fly airplanes and things like that. And there's a sort of this built-in conflict in these two parts of our brain. So there are biological roots to this as well, I think.
Do you have some pieces in the book about those parts of the brain?
I do, indeed, yes.
Would you like to read one of them?
Sure. Caroline, do you have one specifically you'd like me to read, or do you want me to just go ahead?
Well, The Alchemist, yeah.
Uh-huh.
This is, I go down the street, walk down the street, and I see people, and they are engaged with their devices, and they don't look up, they don't read anybody, I don't understand that. Because I love to go in the store, and I love to talk to people, and start conversations with people, and that's what really life is all about, is, of course, I guess they're talking to people too, but it's just different.
Shall I read The Alchemist's Apprentice?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I've got another one marked here about the two parts of the brain if we want to come back to that. But I'll just mention, just as a little background to this, it is called The Alchemist's Apprentice, and some of the things we've been talking about are definitely central themes to the book, but there's also a sort of more general, I guess, social critique or cultural critique that many of the pieces address, and this one in particular, I think I was trying to write something that really just captured this idea, like you say, Caroline, of people really not living in the present, in the kind of analog world of the immediate here and now. So this was just a little piece about that. A talented young chemist was determined to make her mark. Her professional success would earn her personal wealth and happiness. All she needed was a significant accomplishment. Along the way, she had befriended an elderly man who studied the lost art of alchemy. In the waning days of his life, he discovered the secret that had eluded alchemists for centuries. He had figured out how to turn worthless lead into priceless gold. Knowing that his life was almost over, he invited the young chemist to his lab to reveal to her his undocumented secrets. As he began to talk, she felt the device inside her pocket buzz. Who could it be? It was a message from a friend who wanted to make plans for the evening. Without the alchemist noticing, she quietly began exchanging messages with her friend. Should they go see a movie? Where would they eat? They figured out a plan. It sounded like fun. In fact, this would be the perfect way to celebrate this most important day of the young chemist's life. She signed off. She slipped the device back into her pocket and resumed listening to the alchemist, prepared to capture all his detailed notes. At that moment, he looked at her with the most glistening smile she had ever seen. "And that," he said, "is the secret." And all she heard were those last five words. wait, what? And then the alchemist died.
Isn't that perfect? That is just perfect.
A quick
wow.
Unhappy.
So yeah. I do want to point out that there's a lot of humor in these poems and so forth. There's even some of them sort of an Ogden Nash-ish type of style, I think.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that you found that. I definitely was hoping that there was, you know, humor as well as some of the more somber themes. You never know if that will, you know, come across or not.
It definitely comes across. Yeah.
Good.
All right. Let's go back to the two parts of the brain.
Okay. Do you want me to read another piece?
Sure.
Okay. This one, I'm going to read because it really does kind of talk about the two parts. It's called The Noble and the Profane. Caroline, it's on page 36. And it, most of the pieces in here are pretty self-contained. This one actually begins sort of as a segue from an earlier piece, but I don't think there's anything missing from there's an earlier piece that talks about cliff swallows and how their wings evolve and that kind of thing. Cliff swallows have the advantage of evolving without the distraction of irrational thought. This provides them a purity of purpose that can be a challenge for the human species. Without conscious thought, the path to survival is direct. Something either works or you die. If enough individuals of your species die, your species dies off too. And yet extinction runs counter to the primal instincts of individuals and species. So adaptations that enhance survivability are embraced without question, at least among all the species that do not have the capacity for conscious thought.
Yeah.
Cliff swallows, the adaptation of shorter wings is good because it helps the species survive. There is no tradition-based insistence on the superiority of longer wings. As far as we now know, humans are the exception among all the things that live because of our ability to think self-reflectively. With that ability, we have accomplished wondrous things. Medicine, architecture, haute cuisine. Self-reflective thinking provides us the unique potential for lucid evolution. That is, the ability to evolve consciously, with purpose, in an ever more enlightened direction. But conscious thought comes with an unintended consequence. Along with the ability to make things better, is the ability to choose a path that undermines individual and collective survival. Now, how in the name of Charles Darwin can that possibly happen? You might call it a hardware failure or a bug in the program, but it relates to a vestige of the evolutionary process itself. The prefrontal cortex that evolved in humans and which enables higher order thinking did not replace the earlier iterations of our brains. Instead, it was added on to the previous versions, which still perform their original functions. At the core of all this is the amygdala, a component we share with such relatives in the animal kingdom as the lizard and the skunk. The amygdala is responsible for emotional responses like fear, anxiety, and aggression. This means that our highly evolved brains come with a built-in paradox. The noble and the profane share the same beleaguered skull. If the prefrontal cortex represents where we are and what we might become as a species, the amygdala represents where we came from. The amygdala speaks with a voice that says, me want candy, me want toy, me want my way. The amygdala does not think, plan, create, or dream. Instead, it craves, fears, and reacts. The amygdala fears the wolves in the night. The prefrontal cortex figures out how to build a fire. The prefrontal cortex observes the movements of the celestial bodies and figures out how they must therefore be organized. The amygdala imprisons the observer because he undermines religious dogma. The prefrontal cortex writes the Gettysburg Address. The amygdala murders Abraham Lincoln. The prefrontal cortex investigates the principles of aerodynamics and invents the airplane. The amygdala persuades humans to kill themselves and slaughter thousands of innocent strangers by flying airplanes into buildings. The prefrontal cortex enables scientists to successfully plan and complete a manned mission to the moon. The amygdala convinces a small but dementedly certain group that the mission was a hoax. Because of this quirk in our anatomy, we humans have the ability to convince ourselves that the wrong path is the right one, in spite of all evidence to the contrary. An amygdala might save you from a shark attack, but it will not build you a boat. It is a fool who chooses not to know the difference. Let us therefore investigate the ways in which we fool ourselves so that we may cease to do so.
Okay, John, actually, before I ask that question, I want to remind our audience that we're speaking today, that this is Writer's Voices, and we're speaking with John B. Lane, author of The Beaten Path, A Lyrical Guide to Lucid Evolution. So what I'm trying to figure out here is, you started out talking about, in this essay, about humans being the only species that doesn't, that kind of rejects the improvements that help survival because of it's, you know, goes against tradition or goes against what's always been. But then you talk about the amygdala, which is the part of the brain we have in common with the animals, as being the problem for our progress. And yet, Those two things seem to be in contradiction to one another.
There's definitely, I think, a tension between the two, and I think, you know, certainly we still have our amygdala. Each of us, we need them in a certain way, but I think it's a question of balancing the two, you know, the sort of the noble and the profane, I guess, if you will, and. It's really easy to kind of lapse into a focus on the more primitive parts of our brain, and this is where I think one of the things that I think belief systems prey on are fears and jealousies and selfishness and things like that, and when we sort of embrace that part of our nature. At the expense of the sort of better angels of our nature, if you will, I think that's the source of a lot of problems and a lot of suffering in the world, quite frankly. We have these minds that allow us to figure things out. I mean, we're remarkable as a species. But it's so easy to ignore that part of our, you know, our nature. And I think that, you know, there are also, quite honestly, there are some, you know, vested interests who benefit from people not thinking and, you know, looking for solutions and things like that. So, and part of the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, this is sort of a unique challenge that we have as humans. You know, brethren in the animal kingdom, you know, just accept that you either do this or you perish. And there is no doubt, there is no sort of, you know, confusion about what's the most important course of action. But in our case, I think we have this inherent ability to work against our best interests.
Are there, in this prefrontal cortex, is that the part of the brain that is affected by drug use, and especially children that are born of mothers who are on drugs and they have no impulse control? Is that part of that?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't know, you know, anatomically exactly how that works, but I think I would have to think that, you know, this sort of attraction of drugs as a solution to something, you know, maybe is sort of comes from more of that amygdala part of the brain. I mean, if someone's thinking rational, they're not going to be as inclined to, you know, to turn to something like drugs as a solution to their problems. And then once have, then I think, yeah, absolutely, you know, the effect of drugs is going to affect your ability to think rationally, and whether that's what gets, you know, actually passed on to children. I mean, it seems quite possible because you're playing with some, you know, delicate systems in the human mind.
Yes, well, I know of some children that have that difficulty, and that was their heritage was from their mother, so I'm sure that happens in cases. But drugs have invaded our, you know, the use of drugs have invaded our culture so tremendously that it's really frightening to me.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I guess I kind of feel like, in a way, some of these things that I kind of classify as in this large category of belief systems act like drugs, you know, even if they aren't necessarily drugs. They act in ways that disable our ability to think clearly as drugs do. So I think there's a strong parallel between the two.
I want to point out that the title of your book, when we say it, it might sound like Beaten, B-E-A-T-E-N, but it's actually B-E-A-T-I-N apostrophe. What is this supposed to convey?
Well, I guess it's a little maybe signal that that I'm going to be utilizing wordplay, you know, between the covers of the book. Because it is intended as almost sort of a pun. I mean, you know, and as you say, as you know, when you say the word, you know, the beaten path, which is kind of a common expression, it is typically spelled B-E-A-T-N and implies the well-worn, established path that others take, mm-hmm. and, you know, that is easy to sort of just follow along. The implication, in my mind anyway, part of the intention was, you know, with this idea of beaten, sort of a shortened version of beating, is maybe sort of an alternative path that isn't necessarily following the well-worn path someone else created, but sort of embracing life in the here and now, kind of back to what you were saying, Caroline, of people that have their heads buried in their phone, whose minds are somewhere else. But the beaten path is sort of, I guess, a metaphor for embracing life, you know, as a reality, and thereby experiencing the incredible wonders of life.
Mm, yes.
And I got a couple other things from it, too. One is the, you know, just the beat, that the writing is very lyrical, has rhythm, has a beat. So it's like here's a path to evolution, you know, but it's on you're following the beat.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
And then also I got a reference to perhaps the beat poets.
Oh, that's a very, very keen insight there, Monica. Yes. I was definitely influenced by the beat writers and poets. So that is a subliminal, a very subtle reference that I made, and also to the Beatles. I'm a huge Beatle fan, so.
Oh, okay. So this has there's many layers of meaning when you peel it back.
Absolutely, yes.
Did you have this title as a working title, or was it something that came later?
No, that's a great question. This title actually predates the book by, you know, several decades. This title from way back when, and I loved the line, you know, the sort of wordplay, and I just never quite had the right place to use it, and then I started writing this book, and even then I didn't connect the two, and then I suddenly realized that it kind of helps create a theme that I could work through the book.
Excellent. And the cover. Let's talk about your book cover.
Yes.
So it has some layers to it, too.
Absolutely, yes. Again, thank you for noticing. So the cover, I will just mention also that, you know, if anyone is interested, on the website for the book, it's thebeatenpath.com, thebeatenpath.com. There are some alternative covers that were some of the other ideas we worked with until we came up with this. But the cover was really kind of the last thing we dealt with. You know, I mentioned that we spent a lot of time on the layout of the book. And we did try some other ideas, and nothing was kind of clicking with everyone involved, you know, with Anil and, you know, my wife Elaine and other people, my son Adam. Nobody was quite thrilled with the other ideas. I was actually kind of trying to think of something from within the book that could be reused and leveraged. And so in the back of my mind, that was sort of my goal. And I woke up in the middle of the night one night, you know, just kind of laying there thinking, and this idea came for me. And so there's actually a sunflower that appears elsewhere in the book. And it's one of these vintage illustrations that I mentioned, and I think this illustration actually comes from the early 1700s, and it's a botanical illustration of a sunflower that is just an absolutely incredible image, and you can kind of see it on the cover. The detail is amazing, and in sort of the middle of the sunflower, there are all of these tiny little flowers. I mean, it's just a phenomenal image in itself. But somehow it just came to me. This idea of making the petals of the sunflower all kinds of different colors, as if the sunflower itself was evolving, and making the center of the sunflower this, you know, pupil of an eye, so that it actually kind of looks back out at the reader, or someone, you know, who might see it in a bookstore or something. So the idea is actually sort of is intended to capture this idea of evolution.
Well, it all fits together. There's no doubt about it. You know, in the back you have, with love and thanks to all who have helped and inspired me along the way, including in approximate order of appearance. How many people do you have listed there? I didn't try to count them, but maybe.
Oh gosh, I don't know.
there's a lot of them.
there's a lot of them, and it just kept going on and going on, and it was just, you know, a way, because there were so many people that did have affected me, and as I say at the end of the list, you know, after listing, I don't know, there's probably at least 100 people either that I know, or people like, you know, some of the beat writers, Jack Kerouac, who I never met, but at the end of the list I say, and many more I hope to come.
Well, I noticed one here, Mahatma Gandhi. I had a junior high social studies teacher that was a great fan of his, and she told us many things that he had said and so forth, and I never will forget those inspirations from her about him. He was quite a gift to humanity, I think.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's an example of someone who, you know, just through the ages, long after he's no longer with us, you know, can mm-hmm. have an influence on people that follow.
You know, Mom, you've told me a story before about a college professor you had talking about Hitler that I think is apropos to this subject too, because it's how people get convinced to accept a belief system that, you know, when we look at it from a distance, it seems, how in the world could anybody have thought this way?
Yeah, he was a German Jew, and he was in Germany, and he said he was at one of the rallies, and he said he got so caught up in that he was screaming, "Kill the Jews!" And, you know, he said, "Here I am, a Jew." He said, and then later he said, "I can't believe that happened." But he said that was what drove that whole thing. It was this magnetism of that of Hitler and his oratory. It was just really,
and then
something.
The mass, you know, being part of groupthink, you know, mm-hmm. everyone thinking and
yeah. What do they call that, mass something?
These are sophisticated techniques that work. They prey on the amygdala, and we see the consequences. And they haven't left us; they're still here.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think our guard is down. You know, I think maybe there was a time, for example, just to use the example you made, maybe right after World War II, when people they were more on guard and aware of some of the potential implications and effects of these things. And put some institutions and systems in place to prevent those in the future. And I think enough time has gone by that we've lost some of that direct knowledge of these things and the harm that can occur. And I think we're really facing, this is almost a public health crisis, of just the deceit and dishonesty that sort of permeates our culture. It's a serious problem, and we're painting ourselves into a pretty serious corner here.
And you wrote an article for the Conscious Connection Cultural Creative magazine.
Yes.
Called Free Your Mind, Four Ways to Break Down Belief Systems. And you talk in there about sort of mass systems. You say, in effect, belief systems manufacture ignorance and cognitive dysfunction and make it easy to scale non-thinking to the masses.
Exactly.
And that's obviously that's what Hitler was able to do, and that it seems like is happening over and over again now. But if somebody... Is it possible for somebody who has fallen prey to that type of thing to break free of that thinking? What does it take for them to do it? I mean, do they have to be, if you're really in, and it isn't just a Hitler type of thing, it can be any, like these conspiracy theories or I don't know, from my perspective, the NRA, that can you even become aware that you're not thinking for yourself?
It seems difficult to do. It is absolutely possible, though, to kind of break through and get one's head above the cloud of these belief systems. It does seem, unfortunately, rare, and especially given I think that we as a culture don't promote this as something. I think on the contrary, there's sort of a promotion of non-thinking. That's sort of insidious in the culture. And I don't, I can't say I know all of the techniques for this kind of thing. And a lot of times it's a very personal thing. It's a very difficult, it can be very difficult to do. I read a book about, it's by a guy named Shulam Dean, who was of the Hasidic Jewish community in New York, who wrote a book about his, escape or whatever from this very closed, very locked down system. And it was very difficult. I mean, he literally lost his children and his wife in the course of doing this. But it happened a little bit at a time in his case. I can't remember exactly, but he, there was a, I think a question maybe he was asking and got to a computer and was able to start seeing some things from a different point of view, because part of what happens is your all of your inputs get sort of closed off, and so you're not getting any alternative points of view. And so his kind of transition into leaving this culture happened just a little bit at a time. But one of the things I mentioned in the book is that all it takes is one little doubt, one question. And I think, in that article you mentioned in Conscious Connection, I make the point that the word why is one of the most powerful words in the world. The simple three-letter question, why, that opens the door to all kinds of things. And these systems are very sophisticated at not allowing those questions to be asked, And when you are taught to take things as articles of faith, then you inherently don't question.
Well, I think if you look at the history of the world, I mean, I'm sitting here, and part of me is discouraged, because in some ways it seems like fixed belief systems are more powerful than open-mindedness, because when you're open-minded and trying to recognize your biases and try and overcome your biases, you're always questioning your own thinking too. It's like, well, maybe I'm buying into, you know, I think so much differently than this group over here, but maybe I'm just limiting my inputs and I'm only looking at one side and I want to consider everything. And so, you know, I'm not willing to force my beliefs on someone else because I'm never sure of them, because I'm always questioning my own beliefs. But somebody with a fixed belief system who isn't questioning it is very willing to force their belief system on other people, often, not always, but, and so that seems more powerful in a sense. So that's the negative.
Yeah, it's more powerful because you have all of the weight of, you know, it's easier to sort of conform to other people's thinking, and it's also just, you know, lazier, quite honestly.
It's easier. But on the positive side, I feel like looking historically that humanity has broken free of a lot of rigid belief systems. There's much more tolerance and acceptance of different ideas in society as a whole, not in all pockets of society, not in all nations perhaps, but overall in Western civilization, much more able to espouse really contradictory ideas or really controversial without getting thrown in jail or killed, executed. Now it's sort of the problem with, or the thing that holds people back from really, I think, trying to upset the status quo is just the pushback that you get, and I'm wondering how you're dealing with that.
Well, I think it's one of those things where if you get to the point where you are a person who is able to kind of question assumptions, it's hard to go back. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, once you don't believe in Santa Claus anymore, it's hard to, you know, go back to your earlier self who does or did.
But you are saying, making some controversial points in your book about religion, about certain belief systems. Are you getting any pushback? Any, you know, are you getting trolled on Twitter?
No, I actually kind of stay off of Twitter. No, I haven't really. You know, maybe because the book isn't, you know, as widely distributed yet as I'd like it to be. I do sense some kind of subtle things, you know, honestly, from some personal relationships where, you know, people just will, you just sense a certain kind of coldness and distance maybe sometimes. Mm. And I think that's to be expected, you know, because part of the dynamic is, you know, you have to be all in for these things. And if you're not all in, you're all out. And that's the reality.
John, did you like sit down one day and decide that you were going to write this book, or did you have like pieces that you had written and then you looked at them and said, you know, this, I've got a theme going here. I should make this into a book.
It was actually a little bit of both. I had some things that I'd written, you know, kind of in response to what we talked about earlier. And I, you know, wrote some things, and, you know, I wrote a lot of things actually. But then one day the idea kind of somehow kind of gelled or crystallized to do the book itself. And so I did spend a period of time doing some, you know, focused research and focused writing about maybe about a year and a half, So I would say probably three-fourths of the pieces in the book were written kind of with this book in mind. But there were certainly some other pieces that I already had that just fit the themes really well.
John, would you read one of the like more humorous poetic pieces for us?
Oh, sure. I'll read a really short one here that's kind of humorous.
Okay.
It's called Parsimony, which part of my research was to read this whole, you know, one great book on the scientific method. And because I wanted to talk about scientific method, and I couldn't figure out how to condense it for the purposes of the book. And it ended up coming out as this short little poem. Parsimony is a kind of a synonym for Occam's razor, which is the idea that the simplest solution to a problem is usually the best solution. So here's this little poem, Parsimony. Oh, I've tried my share of razors, Gillette and all the rest, but when I crave a clean, close shave, Occam's is the best. And Anil found this great illustration of a shaving brush to go with it.
All right, what would you like to share?
Oh, gosh. I'll tell you what. Here's one I think I can get in. It's called The Congregation of Learning. The triumphs of human progress surround us. They're so common that it's easy to believe that they were simply bequeathed to us with this green and pleasant earth itself. Controllable fire, agriculture, the wheel, woven fabric, navigation, roads, paint, paper, literacy, books, music, buildings, government, water distribution, geology, biology, controllable electricity, movies, television, computers, space travel, cell phones, buttered toast, cafe au lait. We accept these conveniences as irreplaceable parts of our lives without often awaring that each represents the latest result of a series of insights and understandings figured out over time and toil by fellow human beings. Each advance of knowledge by one human was further advanced by another, so that all humans may benefit from this congregation of learning. It is by means of this congregation that humans as a species may inhabit all corners of the earth and communicate as fast as the speed of sound and light allow. It is by means of this congregation that we may overcome medical challenges that before had harmed countless among us without mercy. It is by means of this congregation that we may continue to live in some degree of civilization with billions of fellow humans. The landscape of human achievement is breathtaking, but there are limits to our achievements. Many of those limits are self-imposed, and all of those self-imposed limits are needless. They can, however, be conquered by learning. This exceptional ability to learn is the capacity that distinguishes humans from all the forms of life that we now know. This ability comes easily to some and lies dormant or unknown to others, but it is available to all, and it is available throughout each life. Learning is a continuous process that is mastered with continuous, lifelong practice, and the immeasurable rewards of learning, lifelong and continuous.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today has been John B. Lane, author of The Beaten Path, A Lyrical Guide to Lucid Evolution. Mom, do you have any more questions?
Got a lot of questions, but no. But this is really an interesting book. I mean, it, like I say, you start to read it, and then you know you have to do something else. But see, the thing is, because they are short pieces, you can absorb them in a few minutes. But then you can't absorb the whole thing. Then you have to go back.
So John, tell us a little bit about how you got the book published, how you published the book.
Well, I know enough about the writing business to know that there kind of isn't an inherent market for a book. You know, there's no kind of genre for this particular book. And most established publishers are kind of geared toward genre type books. So I really intended all along to publish it myself. So I found out that actually, you know, thanks to modern technology, there are some options available to writers that weren't even, you know, 5, 10, 20 years ago. So it was actually very simple and relatively inexpensive to publish the book myself through, there's a company called Ingram Spark that actually does publishing, print-on-demand publishing, but also is a global distributor of books, which was always one of the big limitations to self-publishing before.
Mm-hmm.
You can distribute books very easily. And
We've all heard of the authors with their garage full of books.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, you would have to sink a lot of money into buying, you know, a minimum of however many books, and then you end up with, like you say, a garage full. This is completely different. You can order one copy or, you know, a garage full. And then once it's published, they actually place it, you know, on platforms through wholesale, you know, their wholesale networks. They put it on Amazon, and bookstores, you know, anywhere in the world can order copies. So, you know, then it becomes just a matter of a question of kind of getting the word out.
Yeah, marketing it, which is not the easy part for a lot of authors.
No, it's not. I was fortunate to come across an agency that helps with marketing, and they've been great.
That's JK. Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, I want to mention that if you go search for The Beaten Path on Amazon, even if you type in BEATIN, it's going to take you to BEATEN and say, did you really mean BEATIN? And you have to click on that. So it takes, or at least for me, it took a couple of steps to do it. Maybe if I'd put the quote mark after the N, I didn't do that. And maybe if I'd done that, it would have taken me right there. So,
thank you for your persistence.
No problem. So thank you so much for being with us, John. And Mom, do you have some final words of wisdom?
Oh, well, I have a lot. No, actually, I wanted to do this one that Mahatma Gandhi, I have used this before, but all through history, there have been tyrants and evil leaders of countries and people, but eventually they fall, always.
Reality always wins.
Yep.
And hopefully we can all learn a little more about how to see our own biases and really look at reality with clear vision.
Absolutely.
Thank you all, and see you next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye now.